Chapter 7. The Rise of the Second Men. 1. The Appearance of a New Species. It was some 10 million years after the Patagonian disaster that the first elements of a new human species appeared in an epidemic of biological variations, many of which were extremely valuable. Upon this raw material, the new and stimulating environment worked for some 100,000 years until at last there appeared the second man. Though of greater stature and more roomy cranium, these beings were not wholly unlike their predecessors in general proportions. Their heads, indeed, were large even for their bodies, and their necks massive. Their hands were huge, but finely moulded. Their almost titanic size entailed a seemingly excessive strength of support. Their legs were stouter, even proportionately, than the legs of the earlier species. Their feet had lost the separate toes, and by a strengthening and growing together of the internal bones, had become more efficient instruments of locomotion. During the Siberian exile, the first men had acquired a thick, hairy covering, and most races of the second men retained something of this blonde, hirsute appearance throughout their career. Their eyes were large and often jade green, their features firm as carved granite, yet mobile and lucent. Of the second human species, one might say that nature had at last repeated and far excelled the noble but unfortunate type which she had achieved once long ago with the first species in certain prehistoric cave-dwelling hunters and artists. Inwardly, the second men differed from the earlier species in that they had shed most of those primitive relics which had hampered the first men more than was realized. Not only were they free of appendix, tonsils, and other useless excrescences, but also their whole structure was more firmly knit into unity. Their chemical organization was such that their tissues were kept in better repair. Their teeth, though proportionately small and few, were almost completely immune from caries. Such was their glandular equipment that puberty did not begin till 20, and not till they were 50 did they reach maturity. At about 190 their powers began to fail, and after a few years of contemplative retirement, they almost invariably died before true senility could begin. It was as though, when a man's work was finished, and he had meditated in peace upon his whole career, there was nothing further to hold his attention and prevent him from falling asleep. Mothers carried the fetus for 3 years, suckled the infant for 5 years, and were sterile during this period and for another 7 years. Their climacteric was reached at about 160. Architecturally massive like their mates, they would have seemed to the first men very formidable titanesses. But even those early half-human beings would have admired the women of the second species, both for their superb vitality and for their brilliantly human expression. In temperament, the second men were curiously different from the earlier species. The same factors were present, but in different proportions, and in far greater subordination to the considered will of the individual. Sexual vigour had returned, but sexual interest was strangely altered. Around the ancient core of delight in physical and mental contact with the opposite sex, there now appeared a kind of innately sublimated and no less poignant appreciation of the unique physical and mental forms of all kinds of live things. It is difficult for less ample natures to imagine this expansion of the innate sexual interest, for to them it is not apparent that the lusty admiration which at first directs itself solely on the opposite sex is the appropriate attitude to all the beauties of flesh and spirit in beast and bird and plant. Parental interest was also strong in the new species, but it too was universalized. It had become a strong innate interest in, and a devotion to, all beings that were conceived as in need of help. In the earlier species, this passionate, spontaneous altruism occurred only in exceptional persons. In the new species, however, all normal men and women experienced altruism as a passion. And yet, at the same time, primitive parenthood had become tempered to a less possessive and more objective love, which among the first men was less common than they themselves were pleased to believe. Assertiveness had also greatly changed. Formerly, very much of a man's energy had been devoted to the assertion of himself as a private individual over against other individuals, and very much of his generosity had been at bottom selfish. But in the second men, this competitive self-assertion, this championship of the most intimately known animal against all others, was greatly tempered. Formerly, the major enterprises of society would never have been carried through had they not been able to annex themselves the egoism of their champions. But in the second men, the parts were reversed. Few individuals could ever trouble to exert themselves to the last ounce for merely private ends, save when those ends borrowed interest or import from some public enterprise. It was only his vision of a worldwide community of persons and of his own function therein that could rouse the fighting spirit in a man. Thus it was inwardly, rather than in outward physical characters, that the second men differed from the first, and in nothing did they differ more than in their native aptitude for cosmopolitanism. They had their tribes and nations. War was not quite unknown amongst them. But even in primitive times, a man's most serious loyalty was directed toward the race as a whole, and wars were so hampered by impulses of kindliness towards the enemy that they were apt to degenerate into rather violent athletic contests, leading to an orgy of fraternization. It would not be true to say that the strongest interest of these beings was social. They were never prone to exalt the abstraction called the state, or the nation, or even the world commonwealth. For their most characteristic factor was not mere gregariousness, but something novel, namely an innate interest in personality, both in the actual diversity of persons and in the ideal personal development. They had a remarkable power of vividly intuiting their fellows as unique persons with special needs. Individuals of the earlier species had suffered from an almost insurmountable spiritual isolation from one another. Not even lovers, and scarcely even the geniuses with special insight into personality, ever had anything like accurate vision of one another. But the second men, more intensely and accurately self-conscious, were also more intensely and accurately conscious of one another. This they achieved by no unique faculty, but solely by a more ready interest in each other, a finer insight, and a more active imagination. They had also a remarkable innate interest in the higher kinds of mental activity, or rather, in the subtle objects of those activities. Even children were instinctively inclined toward a genuinely aesthetic interest in their world and their own behaviour, and also toward scientific inquiry and generalisation. Small boys, for instance, would delight in collecting not merely such things as eggs or crystals, but mathematical formulae expressive of the different shapes of eggs and crystals, or of the innumerable rhythms of shells, fronds, leaflets, grass nodes. And there was a wealth of traditional fairy stories whose appeal was grounded in philosophical puzzles. Little children delighted to hear how the poor things called illusions were banished from the country of the real. How one-dimensional Mr. Line woke up in a two-dimensional world, and how a brave young tune slew cacophonous beasts and won a melodious bride in that strange country where the landscape is all of sound and all living things are music. The first men had attained to interest in science, mathematics, philosophy, only after arduous schooling. But in the second men, There was a natural propensity for these activities, no less vigorous than the primitive instincts. Not, of course, that they were absolved from learning, but they had the same zest and facility in these matters as their predecessors had enjoyed, only in humbler spheres. In the earlier species, indeed, the nervous system had maintained only a very precarious unity, and was all too liable to derangement by the rebellion of one of its subordinate parts. But in the second species, the highest centres maintained an almost absolute harmony among the lower. Thus the moral conflict between momentary impulse and considered will, and again between private and public interest, played a very subordinate part among the second men. In actual cognitive powers also, this favoured species far outstripped its predecessor. For instance, vision had greatly developed. The second men distinguished in the spectrum a new primary colour between green and blue, and beyond blue they saw not a reddish blue, but again a new primary colour, which faded with increasing ruddiness far into the old ultraviolet. These two new primary colours were complementary to one another. At the other end of the spectrum, they saw the infrared as a peculiar purple. Further, owing to the very great size of their retinae and the multiplication of rods and cones, they discriminated much smaller fractions of their field of vision. Improved discrimination combined with a wonderful fertility of mental imagery to produce a greatly increased power of insight into the character of novel situations. Whereas among the first men native intelligence had increased only up to the age of 14, among the second men it progressed up to 40. Thus an average adult was capable of immediate insight into problems which even the most brilliant of the first men could only solve by prolonged reasoning. This superb clarity of mind enabled the second species to avoid most of those age-long confusions and superstitions which had crippled its predecessor. And along with great intelligence went a remarkable flexibility of will. In fact, the second men were far more able than the first to break habits that were seen to be no longer justified. To sum the matter, circumstance has thrown up a very noble species. Essentially, it was of the same type as the earlier species, but it had undergone extensive improvements. Much that the first men could only achieve by long schooling and self-discipline, the second men performed with effortless fluency and delight. In particular, two capacities for which the first men had been unattainable ideals were now realized in every normal individual, namely, the power of wholly dispassionate cognition and the power of loving one's neighbor as oneself without reservation. Indeed, in this respect, the second men might be called natural Christians. So readily and constantly did they love one another in the manner of Jesus, and infuse their whole social policy with loving kindness. Early in their career they conceived the religion of love, and they were possessed by it again and again in diverse forms until their end. On the other hand, their gift of dispassionate cognition helped them to pass speedily to the admiration of fate. And being by nature rigorous thinkers, they were peculiarly liable to be disturbed by the conflict between their religion of love and their loyalty to fate. Well might it seem that the stage was now set for a triumphant and rapid progress of the human spirit. But though the second human species constituted a real improvement on the first, it lacked certain faculties without which the next great mental advance could not be made. Moreover, its very excellence involved one novel defect from which the first men were almost wholly free. In the lives of humble individuals, there are many occasions when nothing but an heroic effort can wrest their private fortunes from stagnation or decline, and set them pioneering in new spheres. Among the first men, this effort was often called forth by passionate regard for self, and it was upon the tidal wave of innumerable egoisms, blindly surging in one direction, that the first species was carried forward. But to repeat, in the second men, self-regard was never an overmastering motive. Only at the call of social loyalty or personal love would a man spur himself to desperate efforts. Whenever the stake appeared to be mere private advancement, he was apt to prefer peace to enterprise. The delights of sport, companionship, art or intellect, to the slavery of self-regard. And so, in the long run, though the second men were fortunate in their almost complete immunity from the lust of power and personal ostentation, which cursed the earlier species with industrialism and militarism, and although they enjoyed long ages of idyllic peace, often upon a high cultural plane, their progress toward full self-conscious mastery of the planet was curiously slow. 2. The intercourse of three species. In a few thousand years, the new species filled the region from Afghanistan to the China Sea, overran India, and penetrated far into the new Australasian continent. Its advance was less military than cultural. The remaining tribes of the first men with whom the new species could not normally interbreed were unable to live up to the higher culture that flooded round them and over them. They faded out. For some further thousands of years the second men remained as noble savages, then passed rapidly through the pastoral into the agricultural stage. In this era, they sent an expedition across the new and gigantic Hindu Kush to explore Africa. Here it was that they came upon the sub-human descendants of the ship's crew that had sailed from Siberia millions of years earlier. These animals had spread south through America and across the new Atlantic Isthmus into Africa. Dwarfed almost to the knees of the superior species, bent so that as often as not they used their arms as aids to locomotion, flat-headed and curiously long-snouted, these creatures were by now more baboon-like than human. Yet in the wild state they maintained a very complicated organization into castes based on the sense of smell. Their powers of scent, indeed, had developed at the expense of their intelligence. Certain odours, which had become sacred through their very repulsiveness, were given off only by individuals having certain diseases. Such individuals were treated with respect by their fellows, and though in fact they were debilitated by their disease, they were so feared that no healthy individual dared resist them. The characteristic odours were themselves graded in nobility, so that those individuals who bore only the less repulsive perfume owed respect to those in whom a widespread rotting of the body occasioned the most nauseating stench. These plagues had the special effect of stimulating reproductive activity, and this fact was one cause both of the respect felt for them and of the immense fertility of the species, such a fertility that in spite of plagues and obtuseness it had flooded two continents. For though the plagues were fatal, they were slow to develop. Further, though individuals far advanced in disease were often incapable of feeding themselves, they profited by the devotion of the healthy, who were well pleased if they also became infected. But the most startling fact about these creatures was that many of them had become enslaved to another species. When the second men had penetrated further into Africa, they came to a forest region where companies of diminutive monkeys resisted their intrusion. It was soon evident that any interference with the imbecile and passive subhumans in this district was resented by the monkeys. And as the latter made use of a primitive kind of bow and poisoned arrows, their opposition was seriously inconvenient to the invaders. The use of weapons and other tools and a remarkable coordination in warfare made it clear that in intelligence this simian species had far outstripped all creatures save man. Indeed, the second men were now face to face with the only terrestrial species which ever evolved so far as to compete with man in versatility and practical shrewdness. As the invaders advanced, the monkeys were seen to round up whole flocks of the submen and drive them out of reach. It was noticed also that these domesticated submen were wholly free from the diseases that infected their wild kinsfolk, who on this account greatly despised the healthy drudges. Later it transpired that the submen were trained as beasts of burden by the monkeys, and that their flesh was a much relished article of diet. An arboreal city of woven branches was discovered, and was apparently in course of construction, for the submen were dragging timber and hauling it aloft, goaded by the bone-headed spears of the monkeys. It was less evident also that the authority of the monkeys was maintained less by force than by intimidation. They anointed themselves with the juice of a rare aromatic plant which struck terror into their poor cattle and reduced them to abject docility. Now the invaders were only a handful of pioneers. They had come over the mountains in search of metals which had been brought to the earth's surface during the volcanic era. An amiable race, they felt no hostility toward the monkeys, but rather amusement at their habits and ingenuity. But the monkeys resented the mere presence of these mightier beings, and presently, collecting in the treetops in thousands, they annihilated the party with their poisoned arrows. One man alone escaped into Asia. In a couple of years he returned with a host. Yet this was no punitive expedition, for the bland second men were strangely lacking in resentment. Establishing themselves on the outskirts of the forest region, they contrived to communicate and barter with the little people of the trees, so that after a while they were allowed to enter the territory unmolested and begin their great metallurgical survey. A close study of the relations of these very different intelligences would be enlightening, but we have no time for it. Within their own sphere, the monkeys showed perhaps a quicker wit than the men. But only within very narrow limits did their intelligence work at all. They were deft at finding new means for the better satisfaction of their appetites, but they wholly lacked self-criticism. Upon a normal outfit of instinctive needs, they developed many acquired traditional cravings, most of which were fantastic and harmful. The second men, on the other hand, though often momentarily outwitted by the monkeys, were, in the long run, incomparably more able and more sane. The difference between the two species is seen clearly in their reaction to metals. The second men sought metal solely for the carrying on of an already well-advanced civilization. But the monkeys, when for the first time they saw the bright ingots, were fascinated. They had already begun to hate the invaders for their native superiority and their material wealth. And now this jealousy combined with primitive acquisitiveness to make the slabs of copper and tin become in their eyes symbols of power. In order to remain unmolested in their work, the invaders had paid a toll of the wares of their own country, of baskets, pottery, and various specially designed miniature tools. But at the sight of the crude metal, the monkeys demanded a share of this noblest product of their own land. This was readily granted, since it did away with the need of bringing goods from Asia. But the monkeys had no real use for metal. They merely hoarded it, and became increasingly avaricious. No one had respect among them who did not laboriously carry a great ingot about with him wherever he went. And after a while it came to be considered actually indecent to be seen without a slab of metal. In conversation between the sexes, this symbol of refinement was always held so as to conceal the genitals. The more metal the monkeys acquired, the more they craved. Blood was often shed in disputes over the possession of hoards, but this internecine strife gave place at length to a concerted movement to prevent the whole export of metal from their land. Some even suggested that the ingots in their possession should be used for making more effective weapons with which to expel the invaders. This policy was rejected, not merely because there were none who could work up the crude metal, but because it was generally agreed that to put such a sacred material to any kind of service would be base. This will to be rid of the invader was augmented by a dispute about the submen. These abject beings were treated very harshly by their masters. Not only were they overworked, but also they were tortured in cold blood, not precisely through lust in cruelty, but through a queer sense of humour or delight in the incongruous. For instance, it afforded the monkeys a strangely innocent and extravagant pleasure to compel these cattle to carry on their work in an erect posture, which was by now quite unnatural to them, or to eat their own excrement, or even their own young. If ever these tortures roused some exceptional sub-man to rebel, the monkeys flared into contemptuous rage at such a lack of humour, so incapable were they of realizing the subjective processes of others. To one another they could indeed be kindly and generous, but even among themselves the imp of humour would sometimes run riot. In any matter in which an individual was misunderstood by his fellows, he was sure to be gleefully baited and often harried to death. But in the main it was only the slave species that suffered. The invaders were outraged by this cruel imbecility and ventured to protest. To the monkeys the protest was unintelligible. What were cattle for but to be used in the service of superior beings? Evidently the monkeys thought the invaders were, after all, lacking in the finer capacities of mind, since they failed to appreciate the beauty of the fantastic. This, and other causes of friction, finally led the monkeys to conceive a means of freeing themselves forever. The second men had proved to be terribly liable to the diseases of their wretched subhuman kinsfolk. Only by the very rigorous quarantine had they stamped out the epidemic that had revealed this fact. Now, partly for revenge, but partly also through malicious delight in the topsy-turvy, the monkeys determined to make use of this human weakness. There was a certain nut, very palatable to both men and monkeys, which grew in a remote part of the country. The monkeys had already begun to barter this nut for extra metal, and the pioneering second men were arranging to send caravans laden with nuts into their own country. In this situation the monkeys found their opportunity. They carefully infected large quantities of nuts with the plagues rampant among those herds of submen which had not been domesticated. Very soon, caravans of infected nuts were scattered over Asia. The effect upon a race wholly fresh to these microbes was disastrous. Not only were the pioneering settlements wiped out, but the bulk of the species also. The sub-men themselves had become adjusted to the microbes, and even reproduced more rapidly because of them. Not so the more delicately organized species. They died off like autumn leaves. Civilization fell to pieces. In a few generations, Asia was peopled only by a handful of scattered savages, all diseased and mostly crippled. But in spite of this disaster, the species remained potentially the same. Within a few centuries, it had thrown off the infection and had begun once more the ascent towards civilization. After another 1,000 years, pioneers again crossed the mountains and entered Africa. They met with no opposition. The precarious flicker of simian intelligence had long ago ceased. The monkeys had so burdened their bodies with metal and their minds with the obsession of metal that at length the herds of sub-human cattle were able to rebel and devour their masters. 3. The Zenith of the Second Man. For nearly a quarter of a million years, the second men passed through successive phases of prosperity and decline. Their advance to developed culture was not nearly so steady and triumphal as might have been expected from a race of such brilliance. As with individuals, so with species, accidents are all too likely to defeat even the most cautious expectations. For instance, the second men were for a long time seriously hampered by a glacial epoch which at its height imposed Arctic conditions even as far south as India. Little by little the encroaching ice crowded their tribes into the extremity of that peninsula and reduced their culture to the level of the Eskimo. In time, of course, they recovered, but only to suffer other scourges, of which the most devastating were epidemics of bacteria. The more recently developed and highly organized tissue of this species was particularly susceptible to disease, and not once but many times a promising barbarian culture or medieval civilization was wiped out by plagues. But of all the natural disasters which befell the second men, the worst was due to a spontaneous change in their own physical constitution. Just as the fangs of the ancient saber-toothed tiger had finally grown so large that the beast could not eat, so the brain of the second human species threatened to outgrow the rest of its body. In a cranium that was originally roomy enough, this rare product of nature was now increasingly cramped, while a circulatory system that was formerly quite adequate was becoming more and more liable to fail in pumping blood through so cramped a structure. These two causes at last began to take serious effect. Congenital imbecility became increasingly common, along with all manner of acquired mental diseases. For some thousands of years the race remained in a most precarious condition, now almost dying out, now rapidly attaining an extravagant kind of culture in some region where physical nature happened to be peculiarly favourable. One of these precarious flashes of spirit occurred in the Yangtze Valley, as a sudden and brief effulgence of city-states peopled by neurotics, geniuses, and imbeciles. The last upshot of this civilization was a brilliant literature of despair, dominated by a sense of the difference between the actual and the potential in man and the universe. Later, when the race had attained its noontide glory, it was wont to brood upon this tragic voice from the past in order to remind itself of the underlying horror of existence. Meanwhile, brains became more and more overgrown, and the race more and more disorganized. There is no doubt that it would have gone the way of the saber-toothed tiger simply through the fatal direction of its own physiological evolution, had not a more stable variety of this second human species at last appeared. It was in North America, into which, by way of Africa, the second men had long ago spread, that the roomier-skulled and stronger-hearted type first occurred. By great good fortune, this new variety proved to be a dominant Mendelian character, and, as it interbred freely with the older variety, a superbly healthy race soon peopled America. The species was saved. But another 100,000 years were to pass before the second men could reach their zenith. I must not dwell on this movement of the human symphony, although it is one of great richness. Inevitably many themes are now repeated from the career of the earlier species, but with special features and transposed, so to speak, from the minor to the major key. Once more primitive cultures succeed one another or pass into civilization, barbarian or medieval, and in turn these fall or are transformed. Twice, indeed, the planet became the home of a single worldwide community, which endured for many thousands of years until misfortune wrecked it. The collapse is not altogether surprising, for unlike the earlier species, the second men had no coal and oil. In both these early world societies of the second men, there was a complete lack of mechanical power. Consequently, though worldwide and intricate, they were in a manner medieval. In every continent, intensive and highly skilled agriculture crept from the valleys, up the mountainsides, and over the irrigated deserts. In the rambling garden cities, each citizen took his share of drudgery, practised also some fine handicraft, and yet had leisure for gaiety and contemplation. Intercourse within and between the five great continental communities had to be maintained by coaches, caravans, and sailing ships. Sail, indeed, now came back into its own, and far surpassed its previous achievements. On every sea, fleets of great populous red-sailed clippers, wooden with carved poops and prows, but with the sleeky flanks of the dolphin, carried the produce of every land and the many travellers who delighted to spend a sabbatical year among foreigners. So much in the fullness of time could be achieved, even without mechanical power, by a species gifted with high intelligence and immune from antisocial self-regard. But inevitably there came an end. A virus, whose subtle derangement of the glandular system was never suspected by a race still innocent of physiology, propagated throughout the world a mysterious fatigue. Century by century, agriculture withdrew from the hills and deserts. Craftsmanship deteriorated. Thought became stereotyped. And the vast lethargy produced a vast despond. At length, the nations lost touch with one another, forgot one another, forgot their culture, crumbled into savage tribes. Once more, Earth slept. Many thousand years later, long after the disease was spent, several great peoples developed in isolation. When at last they made contact, they were so alien that in each there had to occur a difficult cultural revolution, not unaccompanied by bloodshed, before the world could once more feel as one. But this second world order endured only a few centuries, for profound subconscious differences now made it impossible for the races to keep wholeheartedly loyal to each other. Religion finally severed the unity which all willed but none could trust. An heroic nation of monotheists sought to impose its faith on a vaguely pantheist world. For the first and last time, the second men stumbled into a worldwide civil war, and just because the war was religious, it developed a brutality hitherto unknown. With crude artillery, but with fanaticism, the two groups of citizen armies harried one another. The fields were laid waste, the cities burned, the rivers, and finally the winds were poisoned. Long after that pitch of horror had been passed, at which an inferior species would have lost heart, these heroic madmen continued to organize destruction. And when at last the inevitable breakdown came, it was the more complete. In a sensitive species, the devastating enlightenment which at last began to invade every mind, the overwhelming sense of treason against the human spirit, the tragic comicality of the whole struggle, sapped all energy. Not for thousands of years did the second men achieve once more a world community. But they had learnt their lesson. The third and most enduring civilization of the second men repeated the glorified medievalism of the first, and passed beyond it into a phase of brilliant natural science. Chemical fertilizers increased the crops and therefore the world population. Wind and water power were converted into electricity to supplement human and animal labor. At length, after many failures, it became possible to use volcanic and subterranean energy to drive dynamos. In a few years, the whole physical character of civilization was transformed. Yet in this headlong passage into industrialism, the second men escaped the errors of ancient Europe, America, and Patagonia. This was due partly to their greater gift of sympathy, which, save during the one great aberration of the religious war, made them all, in a very vivid manner, members one of another. But partly also it was due to their combination of a practical common sense that was more than British, with a more than Russian immunity from the glamour of wealth, and a passion for the life of the mind that even Greece had never known. Mining and manufacture, even with plentiful electric power, were occupations scarcely less arduous than of old. But since each individual was implicated by vivid sympathy in the lives of all persons within his ken, there was little or no obsession with private economic power. The will to avoid industrial evils was effective because sincere. At its height, the culture of the second men was dominated by respect for the individual human personality. Yet contemporary individuals were regarded both as end and as means, as a stage toward far ampler individuals in the remote future. For although they themselves were more long-lived than their predecessors, the second men were oppressed by the brevity of human life and the pettiness of the individual's achievement in comparison with the infinity around about him which awaited apprehension and admiration. Therefore they were determined to produce a race endowed with much greater natural longevity. Again, though, they participated in one another far more than their predecessors. They themselves were dogged by despair at the distortion and error which spoiled every mind's apprehension of others. Like their predecessors, they had passed through all the more naive phases of self-consciousness and other consciousness, and through idealizations of various modes of personality. They had admired the barbarian hero, the romantical, the sensitive subtle, the bluff and hearty, the decadent, the bland, the severe. And they had concluded that each person, while being himself an expression of some one mode of personality, should seek to be also sensitive to every other mode. They even conceived that the total ideal community should be knit into one mind by each unique individual's direct telepathic apprehension of the experience of all his fellows. And the fact that this ideal seemed utterly unattainable wove through their whole culture a thread of darkness, a yearning for spiritual union, a horror of loneliness, which never seriously troubled their far more insulated predecessors. This craving for union influenced the sexual life of the species. In the first place, so closely was the mental related to the physiological in their composition, that when there was no true union of minds, the sexual act failed to give conception. Casual sexual relations thus came to be regarded very differently from those which expressed a deeper intimacy. They were treated as a delightful embroidery on life, affording opportunity of much elegance, light-hearted tenderness, banter, and, of course, physical inebriation. But they were deemed to signify nothing more than the delight of a friend in friend. Where there was a marriage of minds, but then only during the actual passion of communion, sexual intercourse almost always resulted in conception. Under these circumstances, intimate persons had often to practice contraception, but acquaintances never. And one of the most beneficial inventions of the psychologists was a technique of auto-suggestion, which at will either facilitated conception or prevented it, surely harmlessly, and without inesthetic accompaniments. The sexual morality of the second men passed through all the phases known to the first men, but by the time that they'd established a single world culture, it had a form not known before. Not only were both men and women encouraged to have as much casual sexual intercourse as they needed for their enrichment, but also on the higher plane of spiritual union, strict monogamy was deprecated. For in sexual union of this higher kind, they saw a symbol of that communion of minds which they longed to make universal. Thus the most precious gift that a lover could bring to the beloved was not virginity, but sexual experience. The union, it was felt, was the more pregnant the more each party could contribute from previous sexual and spiritual intimacy with others. Yet though as a principle monogamy was not applauded, the higher kind of union would in practice sometimes result in a lifelong partnership. But since the average life was so much longer than among the first men, such fortuitously perennial unions were often deliberately interrupted for a while by a change of partners, and then restored with their vitality renewed. Sometimes, on the other hand, a group of persons of both sexes would maintain a composite and permanent marriage together. Sometimes such a group would exchange a member or members with another group, or disperse itself completely among other groups, to come together again years afterwards with enriched experience. In one form or another, this marriage of groups was much prized as an extension of the vivid sexual participation into an ampler sphere. Among the first men, the brevity of life made these novel forms of union impossible, for obviously no sexual and no spiritual relation can be developed with any richness in less than 30 years of close intimacy. It would be interesting to examine the social institutions of the second men at their zenith, but we have not time to spare for this subject, nor even for the brilliant intellectual achievements in which the species so far outstripped its predecessor. Obviously, any account of the natural science and the philosophy of the second men would be unintelligible to readers of this book. Suffice it that they avoided the errors which had led the first men into false abstraction and into metaphysical theories which were at once sophisticated and naive. Not until after they had passed beyond the best work of the first men in science and philosophy did the second men discover the remains of the great stone library in Siberia. A party of engineers happened upon it while they were preparing to sink a shaft for subterranean energy. The tablets were broken, disordered, weathered. Little by little, however, they were reconstructed and interpreted with the aid of the pictorial dictionary. The finds were of extreme interest to the second men, but not in the manner which the Siberian party had intended, not as a store of scientific and philosophic truth, but as a vivid historical document. The view of the universe which the tablets recorded was both too naive and too artificial, but the insight which they afforded into the mind of the earlier species was invaluable. So little of the old world had survived the volcanic epoch that the second men had failed hitherto to get a clear picture of their predecessors. One item alone in this archaeological treasure had more than historical interest. The biologist leader of the little party in Siberia had recorded much of the sacred text of the life of the divine boy. At the end of the record came the prophet's last words, which had so baffled Patagonia. This theme was full of meaning for the second men, as indeed it would have been even for the first men in their prime. But whereas for the first men the dispassionate ecstasy which the boy had preached was rather an ideal than a fact of experience, the second men recognized in the prophet's words an intuition familiar to themselves. Long ago, the tortured geniuses of the Yangtze cities had expressed this same intuition. Subsequently, also, it had often been experienced by the more healthy generations, but always with a certain shame, for it had become associated with morbid mentality. But now, with growing conviction that it was wholesome, the second men had begun to grope for a wholesome expression of it. In the life and the last words of the remote apostle of youth, they found an expression which was not wholly inadequate. the species was presently to be in sore need of this gospel. The world community reached at length a certain relative perfection and equilibrium. There was a long summer of social harmony, prosperity, and cultural embellishment. Almost all that could be done by mind in the stage to which it had then reached seemed to have been done. Generations of long-lived, eager, and mutually delightful beings succeeded one another. There was a widespread feeling that the time had come for man to gather all his strength for a flight into some new sphere of mentality. The present type of human being, it was recognized, was but a rough and incoherent natural product. It was time for man to take control of himself and remake himself upon a nobler pattern. With this end in view, two great works were set afoot: research into the ideal of human nature, and research into practical means of remaking human nature. Individuals in all lands, living their private lives, delighting in each other, keeping the tissue of society alive and vigorous, were deeply moved by the thought that their world community was at last engaged upon this heroic task. But elsewhere in the solar system, life of a very different kind was seeking, in its own strange manner, ends incomprehensible to man, yet at bottom identical with his own ends. And presently the two were to come together, not in cooperation.